If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you on a cold but sunny fall day in the mountains of Utah. My guest this week is novelist Helene Wecker. Helene is author of the best-selling and award-winning book, The Golem and the Genie, and its recent follow-up, The Hidden Palace. Helene and I are also debut buddies. Our first books came out the same month in April of 2013. Helene and I talk about writing classes and pursuing higher education for creative writing, the despair when a book just isn't clicking, the loneliness of being a writer, and the way life can sometimes get in the way of a creative job. Enjoy my conversation with Helene Wecker. Okay, yeah. So how has your fall been?
Oh, it's been pretty good. It's been, you know, October hits and somehow everything always falls apart a little, but we have a puppy that we got in end of August, beginning September, and he's reorganized the house, you know, to his liking, and also just growing by leaps and bounds.
Of course.
And you know, I'm up at 3 a.m. letting him out to pee and all of that, and so that's been a little, you know, it's been sort of an extra challenge on top of everything else, but otherwise it's pretty good. You know, getting back in the writing swing, and the kids are back in school in person, thank God. And yeah, can't complain too much.
Good, good. Now you're over in San Francisco, right?
Yeah, I'm in Pleasanton, which is about 40 minutes east of Oakland. So if anyone's familiar with the Bay Area, we're the one of the last stops on the Far East BART line.
All I know about San Francisco is that two of my best friends both live in Redwood.
Oh, okay.
And I visited once, and it was gorgeous. And yes. I could see why everybody loves San Francisco, and I haven't been back since.
Redwood City is amazing. It's a very nice place. And yeah, it takes forever to get to from here to there because of like traffic and the bridges and all of that. But yeah.
Yeah, very pretty area. But you're from the Midwest, where I'm from. I'm from Cleveland. You're from Chicago.
Yes. Yes. I didn't know you were from Cleveland. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, one of my other best friends, kind of my friend Ben, who I kind of consider my little brother, he lives in Chicago, and he kind of adopted it. You know, he went there for school and hasn't left and absolutely adores it.
Yeah, I miss Chicago. It's really such a world-class city. I lived in the north suburbs, so if your friend has ever been to Great America, the Six Flags Great America up near the Wisconsin border, that's about 15 minutes away from my house.
Oh, nice. Now, are you a lifelong deep dish lover then?
Yeah, I love it and I have to love it. But it is a particular niche of pizza. I think the either or is a very silly conversation to have. There are many categories of pizza, and that is one of them. I don't like it better than other categories. I also lived in New York for a couple of years and developed a real love for New York style pizza. And I miss both of those when I don't get them. basically what I'm saying is I could live on pizza in endless variety, I think.
Right, right. That's the nature of being a Midwesterner, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we have family who lives near Detroit. So of course, then you get the arguments over the Detroit style pizza, which I don't even know if I've had proper Detroit style pizza.
Oh, I have a few times, and honestly, the very best ones, they hold up.
Like, oh, good. Okay.
That crispy, thick kind of outer crust of cheese.
Uh-huh.
So dang good.
Yeah, I think that my brother actually lived in Ohio for a number of years, and he and his wife just moved to near Ann Arbor. So presumably at some point in the near future, I'll have an excuse to go out there and I'll see if he can get me some good Detroit style pizza.
Yeah, yeah, definitely find whatever the best is.
Okay.
It's good stuff. It's weird because I like eat pizza maybe once every 3 or 4 months these days, and I still think about it all the time.
Oh, cool. Well, that's a recommendation then.
So good stuff. And you just earlier this summer, you had your second book come out.
My second book after many years. Yes. In June came out. It's The Hidden Palace. It's the sequel to The Golem and the Genie, which was released way back in 2013.
Yeah, we came out, our debuts came out the same month.
Same month, you and me and Wes Chu and I can't remember who else, but yeah, that was how you and I got to know each other, which was pretty funny. We were like tossed in, there was like a cover contest thing. What was that?
Gosh, there's been a few things. I think we both got nominated for the Goodreads Choice Award.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, there were a few things that we kind of got ended up in kind of the same bowl together.
Yeah, same orbit, which is pretty cool. So yes, and you have released many more books than I have since then. that's like how one of the things I remember about like that month and how amazing it was and nutty and just like what the heck's going on with my life now. But you were just sort of a presence in it, which was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. You kind of end up, you know, even if you don't really like, cause we were mentioning before we started that we have never actually met in person, but you still kind of, you have like almost your graduating class, right?
Totally, totally. Or like your freshman dorm, like your floor mates who like you see them on campus later, like, oh, hi you. Like,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's very funny. I wanted to ask you, because I feel like your kind of, your writing and kind of your presence in publishing kind of, it does this weird thing that you see occasionally where it straddles the line between kind of SFF and literary.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of get that with a bit of kind of Susanna Clarke and Michael Chabon, those kind of writers. And I kind of lump you in with that. And I was kind of curious what your thoughts on that kind of whole thing.
Well, you said your presence in publishing, and I had to like not giggle snort because I'm like, I have a presence in publishing, but I know exactly what you're talking about. And I feel like I hang out on the border in that way. I think there are ways in which it is a blessing and a curse. It's like the double-edged sword, right? It's like on the one hand, I get to be in any number of conversations if I want to. And it does lend itself to a wider potential audience. If I've got a decent book club following, I've worked now with both books with the Jewish Book Council, which has been a huge boon, that they have, you know, basically helped me promote my books. I'm working, my editor, Terry Carton, is also the editor of a number of, you know, just straight up literary authors. And so there is, you know, whatever you want to say about, you know, reach or prestige or something like that. And on the other hand, it's monsters, you know? And so you have to convince the people who don't read monsters to read the book, and you have to convince the people who only read monsters to read the book, because it's also Gilded Age New York and, you know, oh, but she's literary and, you know, and so, and I do write to a certain extent. I get complaints that my book has too much character. My books have too much characterization in them. That the plot doesn't move fast enough, and they don't. They don't move like a, you know, there are people who just want beat, 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 and this is not that. And so I feel like I get a wider potential audience, but I always have to convince people, you know, like this is worth your time, honestly, you know. So, so yeah, and I feel like I'm not, you know. Sometimes I wonder, like, okay, do people remember that I'm in genre, or, you know, I'm like not in, there's any number of cool kids clubs that I'm not, you know, like a shoehorn into. And I don't, you know, it used to bug me. And now I'm like, you know what? I got a life. I got a life to lead. I got kids who need stuff from me. I got, you know, the dog needs something, whatever. I don't, I think it's one of the benefits of being in my mid to late 40s now. It's like, look, I don't have time for that. So anyway, no, it has been interesting, especially, and I think I haven't helped myself by only writing two books in 8 years. There is that too. It's like, okay, and whose radar am I on? And I'm hoping to remedy that. I'm trying to get this third book out more quickly. But other than that, it's just sort of like the story of my life is I don't quite fit here. I don't quite fit there, whatever. I'll just deal.
Right. Well, I was reading an older, article that you had written, that where you basically touched on that. You kind of talked about kind of your Jewish heritage and your childhood heritage of being a nerd and kind of these things that kind of make you feel in multiple places and not quite fitting in one or the other. And I think that resonates for a lot of people, often in different ways, but especially for people that are, you know, grew up kind of geeky, you know, especially before kind of the age of the internet when it's so easy to find other fans. I think that hit, I mean, it certainly hit kind of a point for me of thinking, yeah, you know, when I was a kid and trying to kind of learn what I like, there wasn't really people to talk to about it.
Yeah.
You know, even my siblings were all so much older than me that, you know, occasionally we talk about, oh, there's this Star Wars book that, you know, that they read, that they recommended or something. But by the time I was kind of a teenager and reading voraciously, all of my siblings were out of the house. And, you know, so it is a little bit of an odd thing where you kind of straddle that line in multiple places. I remember kind of the first month when my book was out, I remember going to the bookstore and kind of looking for all the books from, you know, like I said, our graduating class, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
And I remember not being able to find yours. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I thought that she was selling like crazy. And then my wife goes, oh, no, it's over here in the literary section. And I remember thinking, oh, well, dang her. She's in the literary section. She actually she's like a big real writer.
Oh, no. And see, I get that and I feel that. And at the same time, it's like, oh, I didn't go to Clarion. I didn't work my way up from the slush pile at Clark's or Fantasy or any number of those. And so there's that, you know, I did the MFA New York thing and I got my agent through, you know, through Columbia and, you know, it's not like they issue them to you. It's the, you know, I met him while I was there. And so it's like, on the one hand, it's like, okay, well, she's got that pedigree or whatever. It's like, okay, but look, Monsters. Like this is, you know, this is it. It's any number of roads will get you there. And, you know, I was the one, again, not fitting in. I was the one writing monster stories in my MFA at Columbia. And, you know, that was not certainly, you know, I was really lucky in that I had professors and, you know, colleagues in my workshop who were really willing to read this stuff. I know other people who were not as lucky, especially back then. This was the early 2000s. I think genre inflected stuff has become more, you know, more of a thing, more popular, more, and MFA programs have now become more, you know, they're just proliferating. And so many of them are, you know, yeah, like that's what we write here is fantasy or sci-fi or whatever. And that's just awesome. But yeah, back then it was like, I was doing the weird thing and I was really lucky that people were, you know, just willing to read and give honest feedback, you know, on the basis of what it was I was trying to do, not what it was they thought I should be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. It's interesting, especially on like kind of that high level of a, you know, of a master's program. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like that was kind of, I don't know, maybe this is too direct of a question, but was it worth the time?
The MFA program?
Yeah.
Yes, it was. With a number of caveats. it absolutely was for me at that point in my life, in that economic greater situation in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. Because what happened was I was in my mid-20s and I'd been out of college for like 7 years. And I had this career in marketing communications. I'd worked first in Minneapolis, and then I was in Seattle working at a public TV station. And the whole time being like, I hate my career, but I don't know what else to do. And I'd never thought that I could be a writer like as a career. I thought that was like saying I want to be an astronaut. It just doesn't happen, you know? So unless it's meant to happen, if it meant to be, I would have done it by then, you know? And so I knew something had to change, and my, you know, then boyfriend, now husband, and my therapist and I basically said, okay, let's, something has to change. So I started taking creative writing classes at University of Washington in their night school program. And at about the same time that I realized that, no, I've got some talent here and I want to keep doing this, that was when the TV station laid me off. And I had just decided like, okay, maybe I'll go to an MFA program. And so they laid me off and now I'm like, okay, this is perfect. I got like a job as a receptionist at a, like a medical clinic. And I was, you know, it was like something I could just do and leave and be done and go home and work on my writing and my MFA applications. And I had no mortgage. I had no kids. Wasn't even married at that point. And then, you know, Columbia let me in, which I still don't understand, frankly, on the strength of work that I can't even look at now. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to New York. And it was like, I had money saved up from working, you know, a quote unquote adult job. I had no real other strings or obligations or anything. And, you know, it was before the recession. It was before COVID. It was before everything. And I could sort of stare down the insane debt that I was about to get into and be like, I got the rest of my life to pay this off. And, you know, it wasn't as blithe as that. I mean, it was, you know, it was a bit of soul searching. But it was right for me. And I knew that I thrive in an academic environment. I'd figured that out about myself. I wanted to just go and be in a boot camp. And if Columbia was going to let me in, then hell, I was going to do it at Columbia. So that was that decision. But it really, there were a number of people in the program who really probably should not have been there, not in terms of talent, they were talented as heck, but they just wanted people to tell them how awesome they were and weren't accepting criticism. And it's like, why are you paying all this money to sit here and tell us, you know, well, you don't understand what I'm trying to do here. It's like, okay, well, yeah, we don't. So you have to show that on the paper. You know, like there were a number of personalities there. But I was lucky that I fell in with there were a lot of, like you said, in like who you matriculate with. I had a number of really great writers in my workshops who I'm still really good friends with to this day. And a number of them live here in the Bay Area, or have moved, you know, we're all like either married and divorced or with kids or we're not and moved and come back. And, you know, so it's like we've all been, it's like a group that we've all sort of stayed in touch. And so, so that has, and that as much as like the classes themselves, especially in the first few years after like getting out of the program, were having that group was invaluable. It was like we would meet up like every month or 6 weeks at someone's house and drink wine and commiserate about how hard it was to like work a day job and try to finish our books at the same time. And we can't, you know, it's you can only complain to your spouse so much, right? Because they're going to just start getting so pissed off. And so it was like someone we, it was like, it was free therapy with wine was basically what it was. And we did this for a number of years and we all, you know, started publishing, which was awesome. So it was a real, going to Columbia, like I said, not for everyone, it worked for me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like I have a love-hate relationship with the concept of writing classes.
Yeah.
Because I went to school and, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I feel like the only thing I got out of school professionally was meeting Brandon Sanderson.
Yep. But hey, if that's enough.
But that's huge because yes. He ended up blurbing my first book and yes. I took a bunch of writing classes from him. And so like, it's a big thing, but it's also like, writing classes themselves are like, you kind of touched upon, they're such a weird thing because yeah. the type of people that take them, there's this gigantic kind of range of, you know, the type that want to be artists mm-hmm. and then the type that like seriously want a career. And then there's the type that this is just an elective and they're just doing something for fun for a semester.
Yep.
And
did you go straight out of, was this in your undergrad that you took the classes or afterwards? I don't.
This is my undergrad. Yeah. Okay. I actually took Brandon's first class. I think it was the year his first book came out. So he was not like capitalized big Brandon Sanderson yet.
Yep.
And that was, you know, it was really good timing for me because I kind of got maybe more attention than I would have even a couple of years later.
Yep.
But it is funny how you kind of, you do make friends and you kind of fall into with the type of people that kind of have the same goals as you.
Yeah.
And I'm still friends with some of the people I met in that class.
Yeah, good.
One of them lives right down the street and works for Brandon as a full-time artist. And he did maps for my books.
Oh my God.
And so, yeah, it's kind of a weird thing. You know, they talk about school in general as, you know, this is where you go to learn stuff. But mm-hmm. I sometimes think actually it's where you go to meet people, right?
Yeah. And I think that was one of the benefits for me of waiting until I knew this was absolutely what I wanted to do and that I'd been out in, you know, the working world for a number of years and I had learned how to pay my own rent and, you know, pay bills and keep the roof over my head and all of that. Because you start to figure out what it is that you need from opportunities. You see opportunities and you start to know how to approach them and how to get stuff out of them.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there were a number of people straight out of undergrad at the Columbia program, some of whom went on to be phenomenal writers and published and, you know, including like a couple really good friends. But I remember looking at them and being like, oh my gosh, what even like life experience is there for you to write about yet, you know, which was like really arrogant of me because, you know, a lot of these people came from, you know, backgrounds where there is a lot to talk about by the time you, you know, get out of high school. But it was also just like, I'm just glad that I waited.
Yeah.
I'll put it that way. I was way too immature straight out of undergrad to have gone into creative writing. I needed to be out in the world for a bit.
You said something a little bit earlier that I thought was fascinating, which was you said that you figured out that you were, that you kind of were comfortable in academia.
Yeah.
And I was just earlier this morning, I was recording another episode with Joe Abercrombie. And we were talking about how neither of us really likes research. Like, you know, if we can get it from Wikipedia, that's like ideal. And I saw in one of your things where you talked about how you love research.
Yeah.
And
I just thought that that kind of stark difference between just two people that ostensibly do the same thing for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Page Break listeners. Brian here, rudely interrupting myself for a bit of a plug. Making a podcast isn't free, and I'm hoping that you enjoy it enough to pitch in a pittance. To do so, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak, where you can toss as little as $3 a month into the tip jar, $5 a month to get the podcast ad-free and early, and $10 a month to hear your name in the credits and feel a smug sense of superiority. You can also buy my books from your favorite retailer or direct from my website. Thanks to everyone who contributes. Now back to me.
Where do you like research from? Like, that feels like homework to me, and I hate it.
It's that sort of curiosity killed the cat thing. I'm very, very curious about just, well, how did that work? And what did people think of that back then? And what, you know, just wanting to know details. And so then I go looking for the details, and then I find out any number of things, and I'm like, well, I need to learn about that more, and then I get more books, and then I have to, and then it's like, oh wait, but this thing over it really is like the Wikipedia rabbit hole, except like with interlibrary loan with books from, you know, universities and stuff, you know, because, and I mean, gosh, especially now with so much archival stuff is on the internet now that, you know, it used to be back when I was first writing the first book, it was, okay, I need to go, like, you know, I was at Columbia at the time and I had to, you know, I was lucky enough to have access to their libraries. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to go down, you know, seven floors into the stacks here and walk down this aisle that clearly hasn't been dusted in about 2 years and pick up, you know, this book off the shelf that, you know, no one has ever opened since it was first published in 1903. And now these days it's like, well, that book is just on Google Books and, you know, you can read it for free. And 17 other books that you want on the same subject are also on Google Books that you can read for free. But I mean, I don't know, to get back to your story of why, your question of why do I like research? I honestly don't know. I just think it's really cool to find things out, and it's no more complex or highfalutin than that. It's like, I know a thing now that I didn't know before, and that makes the world a little more understandable. And I mean, growing up, I mean, it's probably my parents too. We, you know, we had, you know, back before everyone had phones at the table, we had one of those giant world encyclopedias that was, you know, 13 volumes that was upstairs. And every few days at the dinner table, someone would ask a question of like, why is this or why is that? And we'd end up with half the volumes from upstairs brought down to the dinner table, and we're all looking things up. And it was just part of the, you know, it was something my parents encouraged, was being curious about things and then just learning.
That's cool. That's kind of a cool, like, thing to take away from your childhood, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, my dad was the one who got me into sci-fi. He's an engineer by training, and my mom was a librarian by training. And so that was all, we just, you know, asking questions and trying to find things out was sort of like one of the family pastimes.
It's funny because you, just as you were saying that, I realized that my kind of perception of school is not as a place of learning. My perception of school is just as a place where people tell you to do things you don't want to do.
Yeah, I get that quite a bit. That is yeah, I was lucky in that I'm just, for whatever reason, wired to be good at school. And it's not even learning. It's just being good at school. I was always good at standardized tests. Mm-hmm. I was always good at, you know, to some extent it's studying. I think I've got a little bit of ADHD, and that sort of, you know, threw a wrench into the things that I didn't want to do, like, you know, math. But everything else, like, I was the one who, you know, in English class, you're assigned three chapters. Well, I'm going to read six just because I don't want to put the book down. That was, you know, and then I would go in and ace the test the next day and, you know, feel like, well, it wasn't really work. That was just reading. So, but I see, and I, what's funny is I see my kids, my daughter is pretty much the same as I was. And my son is exactly the same as what you're describing, which is also what my husband was, which was, why am I here? These people are just ordering me around and giving me busy work, and I hate it, and I can't wait to leave. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I totally get that.
I wish that I had had a healthier relationship with that kind of thing when I was a kid, but mm-hmm. I felt that way about school. I felt that way about church. Felt that way about, yep. Kind of extracurricular activities.
Yes. Like, you're just marking time, right?
Yeah.
It's like, just marking time. Let me leave. Watching the clock.
Yeah. But I don't know. It's everybody kind of comes out of their childhood and their experiences with, being a young person with different takeaways. And mm-hmm. I think actually coming away with that of liking to learn and being able to be good at learning is actually a really healthy takeaway.
I'm lucky that I had, a family that encouraged that. I'm lucky that I had teachers that encouraged that. And I'm lucky that I had the temperament for it in the first place. Honestly, I think a lot of stuff just sort of lined up for me in that way. And I've managed to take advantage of that. And, it's worked out for me pretty, I like writing as much as it kills me, but I wish I wrote more quickly, but yeah, that's, I think I've been a pretty lucky person all things considered.
Well, and you mentioned that you had 8 years between the two books.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to assume, but I've got to imagine that that's just stressful as heck.
It was murder. It really, I can't, there were years that I just sort of don't remember, because part of that is also that I started when the first book published, I had a 1-year-old. And then I sold. And then I'm trying to think of what the timeline was. But in quick succession after that was when I got pregnant. And now I had a toddler and a baby and then another book deal. And so I was trying to figure out how to be a parent and a writer at the same time. And besides the whole, 3 a.m. feedings and, sleeplessness and whatever, there's also just a certain, at least for me, a really deep disconnect between those two activities, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. with young kids. Young kids, it's about triage. It's reactionary and, you are just reacting to what's going on and you are planning for the next, how to get through the next 15 minutes. And it's just sort of this constant state of being under siege. And writing is then having to think more laterally and associatively and planning out for a larger picture and trying to like pull your brain back from like the situation on the ground. And those two things for me really didn't mesh very well. And it took me a long time to fit, to be like, why am I not writing? What is this? What is going on? Why can't I seem to get anything down on paper? I was just researching and losing myself in the research. Quite a bit of that being procrastination, I'm sure. but also I think I wrote at least 3 books worth of material before I, every word in the book in Hidden Palace is like represents 3 or 4 words that I just discarded along the way,
Right.
And it was just a mess. It was a total mess. And it was because I just didn't have the capacity to have my brain, not my head on straight about all of it for a long time. And so it just got out of hand. And then I would just sit and look at it. And there are nights where I was just like lying in bed, staring up at the ceiling, being like, well, I'm going to have to figure out how to give back the advance. And I'm going to have to get another job. Maybe I'll just raise chickens. I could be a homesteader. I could do that. Yeah, that could work. And, it's just those like really dark night of the soul things about it. And eventually the kids got old enough and HarperCollins stopped giving me extensions and COVID hit. And then, you know, so last summer, summer 2020, my husband took over the entire household for 2 months so I could sit in a tent in our backyard and write. And that was like my pandemic summer. What I did last summer was just finally finished the book and turned it in, you know, basically by the skin of my teeth. And that, you know, I can't do that again. I don't want to do it again. I think my whole entire family will leave me if I do that, you know, like they will take a vote and they will kick me out is what will happen if I try to do that again. But that was just, it was just what needed to happen for whatever reason, for whatever time in my life that was. It was like that book just needed 8 years and it sucked. And I'm just glad it's done.
Yeah, for sure. I think that people that kind of look at what we do for a living and look at, you know, say, oh, a full-time author, that sounds like the best thing in the world. In a lot of ways, I absolutely love my lifestyle and my job and everything. But I think people don't really realize just how difficult it is to, first of all, be a self-employed in general.
Yeah.
And then take on top of that a creative, like, field that you're in. It's just, you know, every single distraction hits you 10 times harder than other people.
And you can get so far up your own butt without even realizing it. Just because of the solitude. It's like,
yeah.
I went down so many dead ends that I was convinced this is what's going to save the book. And, you know, it was just another dead end and I just couldn't see it. And, you know, eventually I was able finally to like get the perspective that I needed. And, you know, cause I finally got some readers to get me some good feedback, but yeah, just writing at home alone is wonderful and freeing, and it is deeply lonely, and it's just really hard to figure out what the heck you're doing on any given day.
Yeah, and you, I noticed that kind of looking at especially some of the nonfiction articles you've written before, that you do kind of, you dwell a little bit on kind of the loneliness, and we touched on that earlier. Kind of, you know, the loneliness of being kind of, you know, either religiously different or your pop culture is different than what other people like. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that's very fascinating to me because I grew up in a very big house where my parents raised 6 kids, but I was the youngest by 6 years. And so by the time I hit 12, I was the only child in this big crumbling house with a big yard.
Oh my gosh.
And so like, it's, I don't know, it just resonated with me because that kind of these ideas of loneliness, I don't think they always create authors.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't think every author's backstory comes from being a lonely kid, but I think lots of us do.
Yeah.
And it's
a lot of time spent in your own head,
yeah.
Even if you're around other people. I mean, sometimes it's the loneliness of like your situation in which that's sort of like what's presented to you. I was a very anxious, dreamy kid, and I spent a ton of time in my own head. I grew up in a family of 4, very tight, very loving. It's not like I was abandoned to my own devices or anything. It was just who I was that I was the one reading Star Trek novels, walking between class, like with my head down in the book and my backpack on me. And I would bump into people and they would laugh at me. And that was, it's funny to me that you say, you know, and I think I do, I dwell too much on like sort of the loneliness of it all. And I think part of that is because I'm trying to get into my characters and they are very lonely people by nature. And so I think there's a certain feedback loop that happens in which I have to remind myself, no way, I do have like a very loving family and a very, you know, there are people out there who would miss me if I was gone. And, you know, so it's like, I don't know why it sort of ended up that way. But yeah, I think a lot of us were just sort of lonely, weirdly lonely kids. And I think there's even with the internet today, I think maybe even, not just despite, but because of the internet today, I think there's a lot of kids who go through the same. And so it's like, I'm writing for them too, I think.
Yeah. That's cool. Do you think about your audience a lot?
I don't, You know, that's a really good question. I think I do, but I'm not sure who to picture. because I do get sort of, you know, the Florida boobies on the one hand and the 12-year-olds on the other, who the Florida boobies give the book to. And that's actually a really cool thing. I've had, you know, quite a few readers tell me that they shared the book with their kids and that it became, you know, something they talked about together. And that's, you know, I mean, I remember doing that with books with my parents. And so that's just an awesome, awesome thing. I think, you know, I've always sort of subscribed to the write the book that you want to read but isn't out there yet philosophy. So I don't think I have like a demographic in mind beyond like people who are like me and like the stuff that I'm into. But I do want to write and I do want to entertain them and I do want to feel like they're getting their money and time's worth out of the book. And, you know, I also know that it's not for everyone. So, I mean, I don't know if you ever get this. If people come up to me and say, Helene, I'm really, really sorry. I started your book and then I put it down and it wasn't even that I didn't like it. I'm like, stop talking. I did that last Thursday with a book that was completely fine and I have no idea why I put it down and I just did. You know, it's like, it can't be everything to everyone. It can't be the, you know, and sometimes, I don't know about you, but last year, like I couldn't finish a book to save my life. It was so hard to just keep my brain on anything. I feel like there's like, when I picture my audience, it's not a person, it's more like sort of like a crowd of expectant people that I have to sort of produce a thing for, and I want to make the best thing I can for them.
Right. That makes sense. I don't know. It's interesting because I feel like every author has a totally different relationship with their audience and their career and, you know, kind of how they feel about themselves as a writer. Mm-hmm. And do you, I know you kind of, you mentioned that you, in the gap between books, you had a couple of those kind of dark moments of the soul kind of thing. Do you kind of look forward in your career over the next, you know, 30 years and try to envision it? Or does that feel a little bit too overwhelming?
Oh gosh. Right now, it feels a little too overwhelming to look beyond the next book. I have ideas of things I'd like to do that would be, you know, more about trying something completely new, not like, you know, book ideas or outlines that I've got in my pocket or anything, more like, you know, it would be really cool to try to write for TV, you know, that sort of, or, you know, to write a graphic novel. How would I even do that? And I guess the theme between those is like, well, that would be collaborative and that would be, you know, having a working relationship with someone. And maybe that's like something that I'm interested in is getting out of like my little bedroom that you see before you. I don't know. I feel like I'm just so lucky to be where I am right now with things that and so much of the rest of my life is sort of dependent on what's going on with my family.
Yeah.
I'm just going to ride this for a while. And I think I will change directions when I feel I need to. But I certainly don't have like a 5 or 10 year plan. I used to be the kind of person who was like, you have to have a plan. You have to know where you're going. And now I'm like, you know what? It'll be okay. I'll figure it out. It'll be fine.
I feel like kind of that, I don't know, blind optimism, maybe. I feel like it resonates with me a little bit more every year.
Yeah.
I think of myself as kind of a positive nihilist, like nothing matters and that's fine.
Yeah.
And it actually makes looking at, you know, trying to envision the next, you know, decade of my life or whatever, it makes it a little easier because it's like, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it'll work out, you know, yeah. I'll put the work in, I'll do what I can and hopefully everything will be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of that is like just having learned lessons of, you know, I have, especially with, you know, with Hidden Palace, I had a plan. I had a big, long plan broken out into chapters and, you know, an outline and all of that. And it all crashed and burned and I had to rebuild it from scratch. And so some of it is, and then, you know, so that's like the work side of it. And then like the rest of my life side of it is like, well, we didn't plan for COVID. we all managed, you know, that was, we all managed to, you know, my family, you know, we were very lucky. No one got ill, but it certainly upended our life for, you know, 2 years or a year and a half and counting now. And so I think one thing that has sort of fallen out for me on just the last 8 years is to be a little looser with myself about that and a little more forgiving about, you know, if I don't have a long-term, you know, 10 bullet point sort of thing planned for myself, just, you know, okay, fine. You'll get there. You'll do it.
I talk to my therapist a lot about not beating up on myself.
Yeah.
Because it's that vicious cycle of once you start beating up on yourself too much, like it's always good to kick yourself in the pants occasionally, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But once you beat up on yourself too much, then you get depressed and then you don't do the thing you're supposed to do anyways. And then you beat up on yourself more.
Yep. And then it's like you're fighting with yourself, and it's that angrily eating ice cream at 11 p.m. sort of feeling of like, well, I'm going to show you all by doing something that's really not productive. You know, it's like, who exactly is winning in this situation? The answer is no one. But, you know, I feel myself doing it anyway sometimes.
Yeah.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Do you think having kids has forced you to kind of be a little bit more loose, a little bit more malleable as a person?
I think yes, in a word. and there's a lot. Oh, there's a lot in there. definitely, because so my younger child is neurodiverse. He's on the autism spectrum with some ADHD sprinkles on top. And that, you know, it has lent a certain air of unpredictability to home life in some ways, in ways both big and small. Things like, you know, we thought that you could just put a kid in school and they were fine. And kids just went to school and there was, you know, how am I going to put this without sounding like I'm ragging on my son, because I'm absolutely not.
Right.
He's a round peg in a square hole sometimes. Mm-hmm. And we will get the calls from school. And, you know, it's like, okay, stop everything. Go in, you know, assess the situation. What actually happened? What needs to be fixed about here? What can we do to support him in the classroom? He's only seven. So, and, you know, he had a year and a half of distance learning, and now he's back in the classroom with 23 other kids, and that's a lot. So, you know, and it's getting, you know, it's better now. There's like adjustments happening on everyone's part. But, you know, back in September, it was like, you know, am I going to get through the day without a phone call? And it was, you just have to accept it as it happens, accept the situation as it is. There's no point in being angry at anyone. It's okay. The day stops. I go in. I support my son. I talk to the administration. We all figure it out. we take the meetings that we need to, and we go forward and we support him at home. And, you know, and then also we have an entire other kid who also need, remember that she needs attention too. And we need to work with her and we need to, you know, and do her activities and all that stuff. And so what can happen sometimes is that the writing gets sort of shunted to the side. And I know, you know, and it's this constant balance of, okay, so today was not a career day. That's okay. There will be career days. You know, that doesn't, it isn't an excuse to just, you know, say, okay, well, the whole day is screwed, so I can just like sit and watch Netflix or whatever. But it's also like, this is my life and I am living it as I need to. And so, yeah, there is a certain amount of flexibility that has to come from that, because it's either that or turn into a person that I wouldn't want to be around, you know? I need to be the mom that my kids need, and I need to be the writer that my books need. And sometimes that those two things happen on the same day, and sometimes they don't. And that's just how it goes.
Yeah, it's tough to kind of think about yourself as one type of person, and then life changes. You know, you have kids, or you get a career, or whatever, and then you realize maybe you're not the type of person you thought you were, or maybe you realize you have to become a different type of person.
Yes. Yes, exactly. There is a very steep learning curve that, you know, I think any major life change hands you to begin with. But, you know, also, you know, what we're trying to do here, like you and me and all the other writers, this isn't easy. It's like there isn't like the office structure. There isn't a career ladder that you see in front of you every single day where you can be like, okay, well, I'm going to go from this role to this role to this role, and I can jump sideways if I need to. And here's our, you know, competitors across the street, and here's how they do it. It's so much more amorphous than that. And just having to figure out from, you know, maybe not from scratch, but from sometimes not much more than scratch, like, and then going forward from there, and making sure, you know, you've got support and your family has support and all of that. It's a lot. I mean, it's a privilege to be able to do it. It's also just a heck of a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And so this kind of shoehorns in with something I was curious about. What, when you're going about your day, what do you consider work time? Like, if you look back at your day after having done it, what kind of pieces of the creative process do you consider work, and what kind of pieces do you not consider work?
Oh, good question. Certainly, like, the sitting down in front of the computer and writing is work.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, and I shouldn't say weirdly enough because I think a lot of people do this, I get a lot of creative thought done in the shower.
Oh, yeah, definitely. One of my favorite creative spots.
Totally. And so I will just like be in there thinking, okay, so what's going to happen? And that's where like I do my forward planning for like, you know, the next like, okay, where do I need to be in a couple chapters? How am I going to get from here to there? That's like done in the shower, weirdly enough. And then, so there's that. And then there's the writing itself. If I'm doing research, if I'm having, yeah, see, I'm trying to change my sort of daily setup now. I'm trying to push the research, like the longer term research, to the afternoon. If I need to look up a thing, like, okay, like a specific piece of information, like, okay, in this time period, I've got a character who's going to go out to lunch somewhere in Midtown in 1930 or whatever. And he's this class and he's this, you know, profession. What restaurant, what street would he have gone to? What type of restaurants would he have gone to? You know, just like those little salient details that like, you know, here and there really will draw a picture. If I do that, that's like a quick and dirty research during the writing process. If I'm looking to get more of a background idea of a particular time period or you know, like with the previous book, it was, you know, I need to learn about World War One. Okay, well, that's not like a quick and dirty Wikipedia search. That's, you know, what was the political situation in the Middle East that, you know, led the Ottoman Empire to throw in with Germany, blah, blah, blah. So that's a book that's like in the afternoon, and I will take notes. I'll sit and read and either highlight or, you know, if I'm using a library book on Kindle, I'll highlight on the Kindle or, you know, and I'll take physical notes. But yeah, that's afternoon work. And so that, because I've learned that I get really sleepy in the afternoons, and so I have to get the actual writing done in the morning. If I push it to the afternoon, if I let myself do like emails and whatever in the morning, then in the afternoon, there's a big enough chance that I'm just going to fall asleep at my desk that I'd rather fall asleep answering emails, frankly, than I would while I'm writing. So that's like, you know, I save that stuff for the afternoon. And also because like at this point, you know, my day ends pretty much at you know, 2:30 because I have to go pick the kids up. So, and then, yeah, that's like, I'm front loading my day. Like I try to start writing as close to 7:30 as I can and get as much as I can done before lunch, and then a little more writing after lunch. And then after that, it's, you know, admin, research, and the rest of my life.
I was curious because do you consider the, or at least in the back of your head, mm-hmm. do you consider the admin and the research as part of your work?
The research is, because it feels so closely tied with what it is that I'm writing.
Yeah.
Because as I'm reading and taking notes, I'm like, okay, so how is this going to affect this? You know, how is this going to affect the book? Well, I could have this person over here and, you know, and I start to, you know, do the forward planning as I'm researching. The admin stuff, less so. That's more, that does feel more like a different role. That's like, I am my own assistant at that point. That feels like I've got a different hat on. But on the other hand, that's certainly part of the business of writing. It's just not the writing itself.
Right.
And I do at this point have an assistant who, helps me with my social media presence among other things. And that has been a huge weight off, because Twitter and Facebook and Instagram will suck me in and destroy me.
Yeah.
And so being able to offload that onto someone else has been just a godsend, that I can still have a presence online and not pay for it in terms of like hours of writing lost has been big.
Yeah, that makes sense. I ended up getting a virtual assistant. Gosh, I think it's maybe up to a year now, maybe longer.
Uh-huh.
And honestly, I mean, she just takes care of sending out my newsletter and updating, you know, yep. like doing a graphic for me if I need it, or updating my website. And it's such like a weight off my shoulders in terms yep. of scattered, kind of keeping me from getting distracted by all these other random things.
Yep.
I think the reason I asked is because I realized recently that my entire career, I've struggled with defining what is work for me as a creative professional.
Hmm.
Because I guess in my head, I've always only regarded sitting down and literally typing as the work. That's my job.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So if you came to me, you know, 4 years ago and said, Brian, how much work did you do this last week? I probably would get super despondent and say, well, I only worked for 2 hours.
Yeah.
When the fact is I also spent, you know, 20 hours thinking about the book. I also yep. spent, you know, 10 hours doing admin. Like, but I've always had this really unhealthy idea that, oh, I only work a tiny amount. You know, a good work week is only 10 hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just the pure writing part.
Creative work does not fit like what the American corporate work ethic wants it to look like.
Yeah.
And I remember having this conversation, is really, I've never forgotten this, with a poet in my, at Columbia, in my MFA program. And he wrote this poetry that was just, I mean, heartrending, about, you know, basically being, you know, gay and closeted as a kid and, you know, sort of coming out from that, you know, blossoming out and becoming who he was now. And so he was having this conversation with his dad. He was trying to explain like what it, you know, because his dad was having these questions of like, so what is it that you do all day as, you know, as a poet? And his dad asked him at one point, okay, so how many poems are in a book? And he's like, a book of poetry, like a chapbook or whatever. And he said, you know, like, I don't know what it was, like 20 or something. And he said, well, how long does it take you to write one of those poems? And he said, oh, well, you know, all put together, probably about, I don't know, 8 hours. And his dad's like, okay, so if you take 8 hours and you multiply that by 20, you should be able to write a book of poems in about a week. And, you know, and he's doing like this journeyman math. And all I can think is, oh my God, you'd end up in a mental hospital trying to do that much creative work in that short of amount of time. Like with all of this, like, you could tell every word of these poems was just ripped out of this guy's soul. And it's like, you can't do that 8 hours a day. It doesn't work. It just doesn't. You know, you do a little of that and then you go eat lunch and you let your brain cook and then you come back and then you write a few more words. And then, you know, you throw away three of the words that you wrote before. And then you get up and you walk around and you hate yourself. And that's just how it works. You know, that's just how a poem happens. It's, you can't do it the way that, you know, like a tool and die sort of thing. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. I feel like hating yourself is sometimes part of the creative process, right? Like
it feels, unfortunately, like that's just it is one of the pit stops you just come back to every once in a while.
Right. And I don't think I even, cause I tend to not be, I tend to not over romanticize what I do for a living as kind of like mm-hmm. great art or anything. But even coming from kind of a more, I don't know, more workman perspective, I still kind of look at it and think, man, you know, it's so much different than doing a normal job. And,
yeah.
And the creativity, you know, like hating yourself is just, you know, you work in this cycle of kind of, okay, I did a really good job on this thing. I'm pleased with it. I'm going to move on. I'll do this next thing. And then suddenly you realize, oh, actually this next thing is making the last thing not work. Oh, I hate that.
Yes.
Oh, dang it. Yes. What am I going to do? And you're kind of constantly working on this weird creative puzzle.
Yes.
That,
and the picture on the box keeps changing. That's the thing that kills me.
It totally does.
It's like, it's like, okay, I had this piece and I have this piece and I have this piece and I don't know where they all go now because the thing that I thought I was making is not the thing that I was making. And now I've got these pieces for some other thing. Well, can that be this thing? I don't know. We'd have to change this thing, you know, and yeah. I get real articulate about it, if you can tell.
Well, and when you say something like, oh, you hate yourself, you say that to somebody, you know, that doesn't write for a living, and they'll kind of look at you and say, well, is that healthy? Do you need to talk to a therapist? But it's part of the process of hating. It's not even that you hate yourself. It's you couldn't creatively plan ahead properly to only mm-hmm. do this in one draft, you know?
Yes. And it's more hating the process, right? It's that the process is entirely from yourself.
Yeah.
And so there's no one else to hate. See, like if it was your boss, you just hate them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, why couldn't you plan ahead? Why are you giving me this work now that like completely negates the work that I, you know, did last week? And you don't have that. It's all you. So that's like the person that's the only person left to be pissed off at is
yeah.
yourself.
Yeah. And it's, you know, in a purely corporate world, if you went and you said, okay, I'm throwing out, you know, 60,000 words or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, oh, well, that was the last 2 years of my work life.
Mm-hmm.
In a corporate world, that's a disaster.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of for us, it's par for the course. You kind of have to say, okay, it's not a total waste. I'm going to use mm-hmm. this element of what I had been working on. And I'm going to, mm-hmm. I built a good structure that I think I can steal from myself. But you have to be able to be willing to say, okay, you know, there's 4 months of my life that I'm going to toss down the drain and that's okay.
Yeah. I got really into the whole productivity thing for a while and you know, especially, you know, back in the like mid 2000s when it was all, oh gosh, what's his name? David Allen and getting things done and all of that stuff. And there is a real disconnect between that and the creative process
mm-hmm.
That I think relates to all of this. And, you know, it took me a long time to really figure that out, that I could not, you know, productive my way to a better book. You know, I could make the rest of my life run more smoothly in order to, you know, clear my brain out for the process as it existed. But I was still going to do things like write 15, 20,000 words and then realize they were all the wrong words. But I had to write those in order to realize what it was I was really trying to write. And that's the, that's why I try not to beat myself up too much, is because sometimes that's the only way to get there. And, you know, there's no way sometimes to figure that out ahead of time. There just isn't.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't know, if you were building a building, like if it was, you know, if you were putting up an apartment complex, you know, you'd have to put up scaffolding ahead of time. And oftentimes that early writing is just your scaffolding.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, you're laying the groundwork for what you eventually want to be really solid.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily going to work on the first draft every time.
Exactly.
Honestly, that infuriates me. I hate writing multiple drafts, and I just, it makes me so angry. But yeah, like my first book in every series winds up being multiple draft. And then my second and third books end up being really close to one draft. But that first book is what kills me each time.
That's fascinating, because it's the setup. It's like it's getting all the pieces to the right size and getting them in the right positions. Yeah, it's the logistics. And figuring out, yeah, what it is that you have. That's interesting. That's really fascinating. I'm trying with the book I'm working on right now is the third book in the series. And
so this is still same world then?
Still same world. Okay. And I'm trying my darndest this time to write a full, quick, crappy draft and go back from there and, you know, just make sure that I've got all those pieces in place. And my problem is I feel like I need to, you know, not necessarily wordsmith it, you know, as I'm working the first draft, but I so much of my, a lot of my writing, so much of it relies on like the specific characterizations that I tend, you know, I need to know everyone's motives in down to like the fine grain. And so right now I'm like, forget that, just get them there and then figure it out, because I just need to figure out a better, quicker way to write the stuff that I write that isn't going to take 8 years. I mean, there's got to be a happy medium somewhere, right? Like, it's not either 8 years or 1 year. I should be able to do a book in 2 to 3, you know? So that should be enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Find something a little less daunting, less daunting than 1 year, but not that gives you free rein to just kind of let it wander away from you.
I think the second book, I also had the time span of the second book, like from beginning to end, like the chronology is 15 years. It starts in 1900 and ends in 1915.
Oh.
And a lot of what I had to do for laying out the book and structuring it was just like, okay, well, the first book spanned a year. The second book cannot be 15 times longer than the first book. So I had to learn how to what to compress and how to do it and where. And so for this third book, I'm giving myself another 1 year or less, time span to work with. I'm trying to limit myself from the get-go so that I don't spend 15 years wandering in the desert.
Yeah. Well, and it's weird because that is like a big part of our jobs as storytellers, is figuring out how much time passes in the story. And and it's something that even I don't think any of my creative writing teachers ever mentioned it.
Yeah.
But I get obsessive over, especially with multiple viewpoints, trying to fit everything in really tightly and knowing exactly how many days have passed and all of that.
Yes.
And it always ends with me frustrated.
And you know, and for my stuff, it's okay. And then setting that against actual world events. So,
oh gosh. And that makes it even more complicated.
Yeah. Because so a number of the drafts, of Hidden Palace, I was going to have one character, coming across from England to New York on the Lusitania on its last full voyage before, before it was torpedoed. Yeah. And so, you know, well, that's a, you know, it starts to sound like Doctor Who. That's a fixed point in time. I have to have it be on a particular day, you know. And so what that means is that you think of it like bobby pinning a piece of fabric to something, and then, you know, it's going to bunch up if you don't have it all like smoothed out, if you don't have it, you know, like pinned, you know, down in the right, in places where they're, you know, it's like, okay, think of it like, okay, there's a pin here at the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. There's a pin here at the Lusitania. There's a pin here at, you know, and then it's like, you have to have a flow of the book between those points. Otherwise it's just all bunching up. Everyone's like standing around waiting for the Lusitania to go down, and then it goes down, and then you get on with the rest of the book. It's like, So I had to actually like unpin it, and because it just wasn't working as much as I wanted to make it work. And I had to have her come over on like, you know, some totally, you know, random unknown ship. But I wanted her to come over on the Lusitania for character reasons, because it reflected parts of her life and whatever. But
yeah,
so I have my reasons. I was just too married to the idea. And eventually I just had to give it up and be like, I can't, because it just throws off the rest of the timeline.
Man. And that's the kind of thing when your creative writing teacher tells you to be willing to kill your darlings.
Yeah.
That's the type of thing that they're talking about, is those.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's not even necessary characters. It's ideas that you get attached to.
Yes.
And that you don't want to let go. And the rest of the draft is suffering because of it.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I think a lot of people misinterpret that as like, well, if you love a line, throw it out. It's like, no, keep the lines you love. As long as they're working, as long as like they're doing their job. It's the things that you love that everyone is telling you, okay, man, this just isn't, how far are you going to stretch things in order to keep that one gem in, when if you take it out, you can get three more gems because everything's going to just fall into place better.
Yeah. I think I really struggled with that in the early drafts of the current epic fantasy that's coming out next year, that I just, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I was working on it during COVID, which didn't help. And I think that I just bashed my head against the kind of the moments of cool that I thought that I was working towards,
mm-hmm.
and then realized that I was twisting whole narratives around moments of cool that, yeah, they're good moments of cool, but they're not good enough to sacrifice the rest of the book for, right?
Yeah.
And it's a struggle to know when to pull the plug on that kind of thing.
Yeah. And we get these ideas in our, like these visions of like, it's going to look epic. It's like, it's going to be, you know, is going to be some Lord of the Rings looking, coming down the hill with the, you know, holding the sword high. And it's like, you know what? If it doesn't work, it doesn't pay off. It's got to actually feel earned. And if it doesn't feel like the rest of the book is supporting that, then yeah, it's just not going to work.
Yeah. Totally. Totally. Now, so I like to try to wrap up this podcast asking everybody what the last thing that you ate that blew your mind was.
Oh my gosh. The last thing that ate that blew my mind.
Anything or even that you're just still thinking about.
I'm just still thinking about. Yes. Okay. There's a restaurant here in Pleasanton called Oyo, O-Y-O, just opened, I think like 6 months ago. And my husband and I had our first date night in, I think it was over a year and a half, year and a bit, because of, you know, circumstances. And we went there and I had a grilled octopus salad.
Oh my goodness.
That was unbelievable. It was so good. And I like, it was the kind of thing where you eat it and you just want to stand up and applaud. It was just smoky. The texture was perfect. The rest of the salad around it was, it just supported the flavors. It was one of those amazing, amazing experiences. And I apologize. My dog is growling in the background. He's rubbing his back on the floor and going, roar. I think he's experiencing the octopus salad memory along with me somehow.
Oh, that's very cool. That's definitely, gosh, I feel like I've never even been to a restaurant that would offer an octopus salad. That's
come out here. We'll go.
You know what? I would give it a try. I've been trying really hard to kind of, I kind of grew up as one of those kids that was very picky. And the last few years, I've been really trying to make an effort on trying new flavors and accepting new things. And honestly, it's been awesome. I feel like I like things way more every single time I try something than I ever would have expected.
That's good. That's really cool. And I say that's good. I'm thinking, oh, thank God, because I ate a lot. My brother, he was the guy who like would order snails in a restaurant when he was 15 years old. And my parents were like, what? And he's like, yeah, well, let me try them. And so, you know, that was like, I just grew up in a foodie family, and my kids now, it's like, there are three accepted foods. If you deviate from those three accepted foods, we will throw it back in your face. And I just have to be patient and be like, they will get older and they will try things, and I cannot make eating a horrible experience for them, or they just will develop lifelong aversions, and I don't want to do that to them. So I have to, and it's just so hard to be patient. So I'm glad to hear that you're branching out and trying new things, and I hope that happens for them too.
Well, for me, it took 30 years, so
you know.
But hopefully, we'll get there for everybody. You know, it's weird looking back at it as somebody who's trying to be more into food. Mm-hmm. Looking back at it and going, man, I feel like I missed out on so many flavors and interesting things. And it was all just because kind of younger Brian was scared of trying something.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, who knows what in your brain had to unlock.
Yeah.
For that to happen. And it becomes, you know, just a growth experience. And the cool thing is having those even 30 years later and being like, okay, I'm still growing as and changing as a person and trying new things and learning new things. And, you know, I think, and not being like locked into that idea of who you are and what you like and don't like. And I wish that for all of us too.
That was novelist Helene Wecker. Thanks again to Helene for coming on to chat. You can find links to her social media and books down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. You can also get signed copies of my books direct from my website. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review. Huge thanks to Kyle Anderson and Patrick Hunt for their backing on Patreon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.